Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Nicole. This is Policy Talks.
Welcome to Policy Talks, a show diving into all things related to policy analysis and international affairs. This week, I'm back with my talented co-host, Nicole. Nicole, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Have you watched anything good on Netflix lately?
I watched about 20 minutes of The Stranger Things, I think is what it's called, and then I realized that it was way too intense for how tired I was when I was watching it, so I turned it off and I watched The Office instead.
Well, that does sound like an intense experience. And speaking of Netflix, why don't we talk about communications in Canada, which is actually the focus of our episode today. So let's talk about this thing called communications that impacts our lives tremendously every day. So this week's episode will focus on Canadian communication services and media companies. This ties into almost everything relating to communications in Canada. Phones, television, radio, the internet, and the corporations that control these technologies. Now, given what's been happening in the world lately, some of you might be wondering why it's so important to talk about Canadian telecommunication and media services, given all the other issues that could be discussed. And the truth is that every year, communication services and the media have become more and more essential in our daily lives. The internet keeps us informed. Television and the online media platforms provide entertainment for millions of Canadians daily. Our cell phones have become the gateway to accessing hours of content and endless information while keeping us connected to the world. When functioning properly and efficiently, these services help spark innovation, give platforms for new creators to share their content, and act as cultural hubs to expand audiences beyond the confines of traditional borders. Now, because of this, some academics and politicians have even gone so far as to call for communication services to be deemed a human right.
Canada is lucky to have access to all these quality media services, but sometimes accessing them can be quite costly. Just ask anyone who recently signed up for a cell phone plan and they will tell you. In fact, the Canadian telecom industry has long been dominated by an oligopoly. Basically, Bell, Shaw, Rogers, TELUS, and Quebecor run the market and essentially have a lot of influence on Canadian media consumption. This is what's at the heart of today's episode. What rights do Canadians have in terms of telecommunications services? What's the government doing to generate impartiality and equality in this area? And what can the government do to ensure more quality access for this necessary service for all?
The majority of Canadians have access to high-quality services in this country for communications and media entertainment, but not at a fair price. The effects of a concentrated media ownership landscape are striking. At the most basic level, the costs are exorbitant. According to the Ottawa-based Public Interest Advocacy Center, Canadian households spend an average of $100 to $212 a month for communication services. Canada also has the highest wireless bills in the world, according to a Merrill Lynch report, paying $56 US a month compared to an average of $40 in other developed countries. These high costs disproportionately affect Canada's vulnerable populations, like rural and Indigenous populations, who have to pay more to access basic services. In 2012, the poorest Canadians, who made an average annual income of $17,300, spent $1,538 on communication services. In fact, this was their largest expenditure after shelter, transportation, and food. That's almost 10% of their income. Now, it's been found that Canadians deem communication services as essential in their daily lives, even going so far as to make sizable cuts in healthy food and quality shelter to afford these overly priced services. Given this, should more be done to limit the cost of basic communication services?
The market oligopoly's impact on consumers goes further than just higher prices. Content and access ends up being controlled by these few companies. they're able to force people to take services they don't want by offering to reduce prices or packaging a service in with something else that someone doesn't actually need. An easy example of this would be landline telephones. Another example is Canadian companies putting together cable television packages so consumers have to pay for channels they don't want to access the ones that they do. A good example of this would be your basic HBO package if you want to get Game of Thrones. The sheer size of these companies means that they can prevent any other competitor from entering the Canadian marketplace, forcing people to stay with their current providers and pay higher prices for services that they're just not happy with.
And given the high costs and market domination, some of you might ask, why hasn't the Canadian government done anything? In Canada, the Canadian Radio Televisions and Telecommunications Commission, CRTC for short, is responsible for regulating broadcasting and telecommunications. They also try and ensure that Canadian content is protected by limiting the amount of foreign television stations that enter the market, and also by instituting quotas for Canadian content on platforms like television and radio. Some people argue that the CRTC goes too far by censoring foreign television channels to protect Canadian television content. Others say that the Commission actually does very little in some areas, such as bringing down the prices of telecommunication services. Regardless, there are serious issues of fairness and the appropriate availability of content and communication services for Canadians. The digital age has forced the CRTC to rethink how it manages Canadian service providers and telecommunication companies. Going forward, these issues are going to become more and more pressing as cell phone and internet use increases.
To discuss these issues further, we're joined by Ben Klass, PhD student at Carleton School of Journalism and Communication, where he studies the political economy of communication. Ben's research interests consist of the historical development of telecommunications in Canada, Canadian communication thought, and neoliberalism. Recently, Ben has made headlines after a complaint he filed prompted a review of mobile internet rules by the CRTC. I've known Ben for quite a few years, and I can't think of anyone more qualified to talk about this stuff than him. Thanks for coming on the show, Ben.
Well, thanks. I'm flattered.
Yeah, welcome.
Good to be here.
So I guess before we deep dive into some of the more nitty-gritty of the policy stuff, I was wondering if you could give us just a bit of a refresher on the CRTC and its mandate and really how its mandate comes to affect Canadians in their daily lives rather than the minutiae of telecom policy.
Okay, well, I think Nicole laid out the bread and butter of the CRTC's role. It's called a quasi-judicial administrative tribunal. It functions sort of like a court, except instead of hearing cases about criminals and so on, it administers the Telecommunications and Broadcasting Act. So
corporate criminals, maybe.
Well, no, I mean, it's not quite the same as that. They're charged with enforcing and implementing the policy objectives of each of those acts, right? And they're parliamentary statutes. They lay out, I think the Telecommunications Act has a handful of these policy objectives, while the Broadcasting Act, I think, understandably, as it deals with culture, has quite a lot more than there are letters in the alphabet.
Yeah.
But the Telecom Act is basically about ensuring that people have access to connectivity, that the technology is progressing, that markets are fair and competitive. Traditionally there have been restrictions on Canadian ownership, although those have been loosened in the past several years, and protections for, in terms of privacy and so on. Whereas the Broadcasting Act is more interested in, as you said, promoting Canadian content, making sure that there's a broad diversity of voices within what they call the Canadian broadcasting system. Now, I mean, some of these types of things, they all change over time, so... that act was written in 1991. What we think of as broadcasting now is a little bit broader, and you start to get mixed problems between these two acts.
Yeah, actually, just to follow up on that, since the act was undertaken in 1991, what do you think the basic telecommunication services are that it oversees today? What can be falling under that umbrella?
Well, the CRTC's job is basically to oversee the entire communication system. And as part of its objectives under the Telecommunications Act, it's required to ensure that all Canadians, whether they live in urban or rural areas, have access to affordable, high-quality, and reliable telecommunication services. it doesn't define what sort of a technology that is, because it, you know, a telecommunication service changes over time. The technology is always changing. You don't bake a particular type of technology or a particular type of solution into a law. It's a method. And so historically, the telephone was the subject of this, you know, idea that people should have access to basic communication services. For, I'd say, the latter half of the 20th century, the CRTC regulated and established rate structures that would ensure people had access to unlimited local long-distance calling, for instance, and that a telephone would be installed in someone's house, regardless of whether there was a business case to do it or not. Today, the telephone, I think, is on its way out as a standalone type of communication service, but the idea that people should have access to the ability to communicate on an interpersonal basis, to do business, to access government, and to entertain themselves is just as strong or more so than it ever has been.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting. So just to switch gears a little bit here. So could you briefly explain the issue regarding the proposed takeover of Bell MTS? Now, it wasn't front and center as a media story, but in this case, it's quite important for the telecommunications landscape. So what would the implications be if this is allowed to happen?
Well, the general policy that the federal government has put forward since the 90s in telecommunications is that there should be competition. There's a general distaste for overbearing and onerous forms of government regulation, such as rate regulation, or becoming basically involved in micromanagement of these companies. Historically, the telephone and cable companies were treated as public utilities, and the CRTC would, and a number of predecessor bodies in government, would get heavily involved, dictating what type of services they had to offer. The companies would have to ask permission before they do anything, really. That fell out of favor in the 90s, okay? And the government has relied on competition, opening markets up, removing requirements for licensing, and so on and so forth. Now, in the case of MTS, that province is often used as an example of a competitive market. Josh, you introduced us to the idea of an oligopoly or concentrated markets. In any given town, you've only got a choice between your cable company and your telephone company if you want to get internet access in your home, typically. Sometimes there's a wireless service provider, but the technology is inferior. So in Ottawa here and most of Ontario, we're looking at Bell and Rogers. In Manitoba, you'd be looking at MTS and Shaw, okay? And so Bell buying up one of the competitors basically means it's going to be a much larger company operating in this market, doesn't have the local concern. The prices that it charges here are considerably higher. The terms of service that they offer are considerably lower. And in particular in wireless, what it means is that the Manitoba market, where prices are 30 to 40% lower, is going to start looking like the Ontario market. They're going to go from four wireless carriers to three, and the three that they'll be going to are the ones who also happen to charge really high prices in other provinces.
I'd like to bring it back, if we could, to the idea of basic telecom services. And I know that they're either under review, or that the review has been done and we're going to hear the results. So what does the review of basic telecommunications services entail?
Well, as we were talking about before, there's no definition of what technology constitutes a basic telecommunications service. Okay, so in the 1990s, in 1999, actually, was the first time that they set out to define what is a basic telecommunications service since the law came in. In that case, they determined basic landline voice telephone, access to the long distance network, a phone book, okay, 911, right? It's things that you wouldn't necessarily think of, but it's the trappings of communication services, and low speed transmission capability for accessing the internet. So we'd be talking about dial-up, right, in 1999. You have to be able to access dial-up. Now, flash forward, I think they reviewed it again in 2011. There may have been another one in there, but the next major review was 2011, in which they came very close to determining that broadband was a basic service, right?
Is that the main goal? Is that what everyone's hoping for, is that they will determine broadband as a telecommunication, as a basic service?
Well, I think that there are a lot of different interests. that sort of coalesce around this idea. Anyone you talk to will agree that people should have access to these types of services. It's written in the law, but there's a lot of dickering over who's going to pay for it. What are the quality levels that need to be assured? How do you determine whether someone needs the service or whether they just want it? And I think in 2011, the situation had progressed in terms of the market, in terms of the technology, to the point to which everyone really sort of knew that broadband is where the future is. But they weren't quite ready to say, we're going to regulate this now. They wanted to say, we're going to let the market keep working with this. We recognize that there's some problems. Not everybody's getting access to what we'd consider to be top-notch service here. So they set the CRTC set a guideline of internet speeds that are 5 megabits per second download, 1 megabit per second upload, which is, I think, reasonable. You can do lots of different things. It qualifies as broadband. But here we are in 2016, and the CRTC has just wrapped up its review again, where I think it became fairly obvious that everyone in the room thinks it's a necessary service. Everyone thinks that people should have access to broadband, but still, again, nobody could agree on how fast the broadband should be and who's going to pay for it.
So I guess in basic terms, what's the best case scenario for just your average consumer then that comes out of this review? What would he or she be really hoping for that the CRTC considers for them, not like the Bells and Rogers and Shaws to that kind of benefit?
Well, I think that it's a win-win situation when more people get access to broadband. Companies like Bell and Rogers are naturally averse to risk. And so when they conduct analysis around their business plan, they're going to identify areas that are highly populated, and they're going to build their quality networks. They're going to put their money into there, and they're going to identify areas with lower population density or where costs might be bigger due to geography or existing infrastructure, the availability of which, you know, may or may not be there. And so the people who live in those areas that are being well served by the market, urban areas, and that most Canadians live in urban areas, are doing reasonably well in terms of the availability of services. So number one, the people in rural areas, right, are really a focus of this, where the service doesn't exist in the first place because the market hasn't served them. And number two, an issue that's emerged in this most recent hearing is that we're not just talking about areas where the network needs to be built. We're talking about making sure that people can afford access to it. Right. And I think that there's a specter hanging around in these policy hearings, and specifically around this debate, a worry that the communications industry business types have got, that what that means is they're going to come in and regulate the prices. They've sort of done that with the cable, right? They introduced a skinny basic package because people are upset you had to take so many different channels. In order to get HBO is the big example, right? If you want to watch Game of Thrones, why would you have to pay an extra $60 to get all the other different channels? Right. So the CRTC basically stepped in and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. The minimum level of cable TV service we think people should have access to has to include all the Canadian channels. It can include some American channels, but, you know, the CBC, your local news, CPAC, all those types of things. And then because of contractual and rights issues, a year later we're gonna make it so you have to offer the channels on a pick and pay basis. The basic broadband service thing, I think the people who stand to benefit are the types of people who sign up for those types of things. Say, oh, I don't want all the bells and whistles, right? I just want to have a basic access. I want to be able to read my email, to open cat pictures grandma sent me, or whatever the heck, chain letters is what it is, right? That's the joke. And I think I'd expect that the CRTC is strongly considering implementing something similar in respect to broadband to make sure that people can afford it. And the companies who offer these services, they don't like that.
Yeah.
Right? And
that's the gist of it.
So I was going to say, on that note, say you have a Canadian who decides to watch the Mindy Project on their computer streaming it rather than watching it on cable. So what is the impact of this on content creators? And is it being taken into account on the review?
Well, the issue of what people are doing with these services came up in the context of this hearing. And going back to what we said in the beginning, the CRTC's got its two different laws. It's got its broadcasting law that it administers, and it's got its telecommunications law. And so historically, they've been kind of treated as separate silos. So the issue of what are you watching on your telecommunications service, they'd say, no, that's a broadcasting service. You're watching TV. That's over here in our other hearing. So you don't talk about that here because it's an administrative tribunal. They have particular rules in the way they work and so on. But as we also talked about earlier, it's getting kind of mixed up. People are using the internet to watch TV. And I think that is a question that everyone has been punting on. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of this in the CRT? I don't think this is a particular what I'm about to say. It's not a case of the CRTC punting the question, but it came up a number of times in the early phase of this the oral hearing. You know, it's on TV and everything. The parties come out. You get a chance to talk to the commissioners and so on. I was just in the peanut gallery for this one, but the issue of how do we define a basic service? We don't want to be giving people. Putting money into something for people who are just only wanting to stream HD video and so on. That's not a basic service. Lots of people are saying you have to determine what people need, not what people want, right? And a bunch of people came out against this idea, and I think that the commissioners took this sort of unprecedented step of giving a bird's eye view. Here's where we sit. It was a three-week hearing in the middle at the end of the first week or the beginning of the second week that said, okay, we recognize this isn't about determining what people are doing with the internet. We're going to figure out how to get people internet and we'll worry about what they're doing later. Right. I think that's an important sort of aspect of it. But with respect to your particular question, what are the implications of watching the Mindy Project on cable TV versus watching it on the internet?
Yeah.
I suppose it depends on whether you're pirating or whether you're watching it on a legal streaming service.
So let's say it wasn't the Mindy Project and it was specifically like a Canadian, like a, I shudder to think that, like, a Murdoch Mysteries, for some reason you wanted to watch that show.
Well, Netflix has got it.
Netflix has got it, but, I mean, it impacts the creators of the content that their stuff's being streamed rather than being watched on TV.
I don't know if that's... I think in the case of piracy, I think it's a little more clear, right, that the content owner isn't getting properly compensated mm-hmm. for that use. But Netflix pays rights to... the owners of that content, just in the same way that the cable companies do. And I mean, the terms, the cable company might pay a volume based rate, or it might pay, the streaming company might pay a per view type rate. Those agreements are secret.
Oh, okay.
Nobody really knows outside the industry, right? Let me rephrase that. It's not always clear. The contracts are confidential in the ways that these things are paid for. There's certain models that they use. To pay, but I think the general point is that Netflix proved the business model of making content available on the internet for TV in the same way that Apple did for streaming music. People were up in arms for a long time talking about Netflix. It's a parasite. It's destroying the content creators' ability to fund their things, right? It's paying nickels on the dollar, and eventually there's not going to be any content for them to buy, right? You don't hear those arguments anymore because you've now got Rogers offering its Show Me product with together with Shaw, which I don't know do either of you guys, have you had cable in the past at your home, like maybe when you were growing up?
Yeah.
Do you remember watching the Superstation Channel or Peachtree or anything like
yeah.
that?
Mm-hmm.
They've got Full House playing and Family Matters, right? Carl Winslow and Steve Urkel. Then on the weekend, they're playing Total Recall or Conan the Barbarian or something like that. That's what Xiaomi's got right now, but plus also a lot of new Canadian TV shows. But mm-hmm. if you look at their library, it's a huge library. They have yeah. a lot of TV shows on there, and it's basically the same as Netflix, but they've just got different content.
Yeah.
So I think the real issue about let's talk about the Mindy Project, is that you've got these people, these Canadian producers, right? It's an industry here, and they've done tons of good stuff. I absolutely love the Trailer Park Boys. old timers always bring up a show called The Beachcombers, which I've never seen, but apparently that's an example of successful Canadian culture. But the people who produce these types of things are used to being in a position of supply management where there's going to be a guaranteed return on their business, right? There's guaranteed shelf space for their programming on television, on the broadcasting system and stuff like that. So they get real upset because they see that this, if you were a business and you had a guaranteed set sort of privilege in the marketplace and there was something coming along and people were saying, oh, you know, we like this business idea better, or the way that the sort of market trends are going, and the cord cutting on TV is exaggerated, but if you're in that position, you'd be saying to yourself, what are we going to do about this?
So do you think that's good or bad news for Canadian content?
Well, it's it's definitely a departure from the traditional model, right? And I'll start with the political sort of correct answer, and then I'll slowly move into telling you what I think. I think that the Act was written in 1991. The technologies and the business models are changing. You know, the cable TV was the thing then, and a couple of years after they brought the Act in, the industry got up in a fuss about the Death Stars. Satellite TV is being beamed into your homes from America, and it's going to ruin Canadian content. That's not the way these things work. People get upset about it. They figure out what it is, and they adapt to it. I think the same thing's happening with TV over the internet, cultural production over the internet right now. And the question isn't how do we stop it or what's it going to destroy, but how are we going to shape the development of this in such a way that you still get things like quality Canadian content. You still have people doing jobs, right? And I think that really, this is my opinion, the model of supply management in television programming, it's equivalent to, I've never heard anyone call it supply management, but, you know, quotas, it's on the way out, right? So I think what they need to be doing is thinking about things like tax credits for production. I think that they, you know, are probably considering things like requiring online broadcasters, and this is the number one issue, actually. Figuring out how to get online broadcasters like Netflix, like YouTube, who don't necessarily follow the rules. They seem like they're good corporate actors and so on, but Netflix won't tell anyone how much Canadian content it's producing. We know that it is doing some. It contracted the Trailer Park Boys to do their show. It's paying for some CBC programming and so on. But yeah, that's the question. Not what's it destroying and so on, and who's it going to harm, but how's it going to come out in the wash, basically.
Well, that's a nice positive way to wrap this section of the podcast up, and we'll be back in just a second with a more international perspective on telecommunications.
Listening to Policy Talks, recorded at CKCU 93.1 FM.
For more, go to www.policydocspodcast.com. We're back with our guest Ben Klass and ready to dive back into our discussion. Before we left off, we were talking about the CRTC, radio telecommunication ownership in Canada, lots of fun stuff. Now we're going to take a little step back from that and look at how Canadian telecom policy fares in comparison to other countries.
So back in 2014, you wrote an open letter to the government entitled Open and Equal Access for a 21st Century Internet, which can be found on your blog, https://benklass.wordpress.com. And in this, you mention alternative models of network organization and access must be explored if we want to achieve the policy objectives of the Telecommunications and Broadcasting Acts and ensure equitable access, innovation, and quality of service. So do you want to just expand on this a little bit?
Yeah, I think that as we were talking about earlier, the idea of basic telecommunication service, universal service, a service that's available to everyone in the country has not come to pass. The policy hasn't succeeded as of yet, and for the most part, the means by which the government, this is Industry Canada, the federal government, and the CRTC, have tried to address the issues by throwing money at it. Mm. Okay, so in the 1990s, there were some community-type projects, a community access program, telecommunities, so on, that had public money to bring out internet access to people. Progressively, as the broadband market started to really take off in the late 90s and 2000s, the policy shifted to just doing like an open call and tender. So the government would declare that money was available to companies who would propose, in a type of an auction format, propose to build infrastructure in places. And, you know, that's basically the last you'd ever hear about it. The money would get spent. The infrastructure might get built in some places, it might not. But I think the fact that they did this in three or four rounds, right, and the, it's still ongoing. There was one under the Conservatives. There were several under the Conservatives, one called BRAND, Broadband for Rural and Northern Development. And the Connecting Canadians program in 2015, and now that the Liberal Party has done the same thing, where they announce a big tranche of money and they say we're going to spend this much money and we're going to get this many types of people connected. Okay, but we're still running into these problems of not having everybody connected to the internet, in particular in rural and remote type areas. I forgot what the question was.
No, actually, to this, so given the challenges, what do you think might be some promising alternatives to network
organization? Network organization. Yeah, yeah. So the model of, I know where I was going now. The model of just having private companies do it has been in vogue for a while, and in some places it has always worked, but there are other ways of doing these types of things that recognize having access to infrastructure, communications infrastructure, is important, right? And if it's not going to work out as a business, we still need to do it anyway, right? And I think that there are utility companies, hydroelectric companies. I know the Manitoba Hydro company is a very successful company that has also installed tons of telecommunications infrastructure, currently acts as a carrier's carrier, enabling other companies to do it, but they're contributing to making it more easy for smaller companies to bring broadband in. Municipalities are experts at infrastructure, right? And I think that the idea that a private company is the only entity capable of doing this, even in spite of the, you know, failed track record. And I don't want to downplay the fact that private enterprises has done a very good job in some areas, but it hasn't in others. And it's those other areas that we're talking about here.
Can you think of any other alternative models internationally?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Like the National Broadband Network in Australia or France or something?
Well, the National Broadband Network is a cautionary tale, and I think I'm being generous with that one, because it's been subject to, essentially a national expropriation. So they took the network of the existing company and said, we're going to buy you out. This is the government. And we're going to upgrade your infrastructure to fiber optic in some places and satellite where we can't get the fiber cable to and so on. But the goal is to bring broadband to everybody. Government changed a number of times since that happened. It's a huge project. Mm. And it's really, they buggered it up because the original idea to go to fiber, bringing fiber right to people's homes, got scrapped. And they decided they're just going to install fiber into neighborhoods and then use existing copper infrastructure. And sorry, this is a bit wonkish, but long and short of it is that it's a good idea, bringing broadband to everybody and on the national basis, but it didn't execute, right? So you have to, when you're doing these types of comparisons, you have to think not just that, you know, what we've got isn't working. Private industry isn't bringing it to everybody, and there, you know, places where they are, but is what we're asking to do is how we propose to solve this problem going to work?
And then if I could just ask one more question. So I hear a lot of times about why Canadian or telecom infrastructure lags behind is because we have such a giant country and lots of pockets of rural communities. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Europe, not at all the case. It's very concentration heavy, especially other continents. Like if you look at Asia, doubly so. So is that a valid argument? Like I think of Australia as kind of similar to Canada for like population versus amount of like wildlife and uninhabited territories. Ours mm-hmm. is just a lot colder than theirs is. But is that a valid argument to say, oh, well, the country's just too dang big to stretch fiber cables across it?
Well, I mean, it's a defeatist argument.
Yeah.
I think individual countries, there's going to be different facts and circumstances wherever you look, right? There is no such thing as Europe, I think is what some people would say to that. And it's a bit of a snarky way of saying, that it's 28 different countries. Sure, some of them are densely populated and some aren't, but some of the provinces are more densely populated than others. Mm-hmm. Canada is actually tremendously urban. It's greater than 80% of people living in urban areas. On the one hand, there's problems in the rural areas as well, but there's plenty of other countries that have these similar types of problems of getting broadband to the outlying areas. Sweden and the Scandinavian countries, for instance, I think we're looking at something like three times denser than Canada, but still in that same scale of of having lots of rural area. It's like 11 people per kilometer there versus four. I can't remember what the numbers are, but anyway, in these types of places, you see a considerable willingness to engage different levels of government, from federal to state to local, in solving these problems, because it really is infrastructure. It's a capital-intensive business. The problem with getting fiber optic cable out to a rural community is it costs a lot of money to dig up a trench or to put in poles and to run that line to where not that many people live. That's the one side of it. And the other side is that not many people live there, so there's not that many customers, mm-hmm. right? Well, if private industry isn't going to do that, you need money coming in from somewhere. And I think there's a number of different places in Europe where you see Germany and the Scandinavian countries. Government money and government management of the infrastructure, the cables of the poles and stuff like that, and then they have private enterprise access to provide the service. So it's basically like they put up the wires, they put up the poles, they make sure everything is maintained and all that type of stuff, and if a customer requests, they'll bring it in. And then the internet company connects their big servers and so on and on the one end, and the customer's equipment, the cable modem or this TV set-top box at the home or something, right? And the infrastructure is operated as a not-for-profit, typically. It could potentially be operated as a for-profit, like Saskatchewan Tel does that. But that's an alternative. That's one way of doing it, recognizing that these things are tremendously expensive, that private industry isn't going to undertake to do it on their own, but that there's still a role for government and private industry to do. That's what I meant when I was talking in that mm-hmm. letter anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you want to go there? So just speaking of challenge, not unique to Canada, but definitely one of the main challenges in ensuring equal access to internet and communication services across Canada is our Arctic regions. And you were saying before about rural communities and how difficult it can be to extend even adequate infrastructure for these services to these communities. And in the Arctic regions, this is especially problematic. The distance is often incredibly great, although we have discussed how that can be a bit of a defeatist argument. But in the Arctic, oftentimes it is a reality. So do you think Canada should take any steps to enshrine internet and access to communication services as a universal right?
Well, I think the right to communicate, or the idea of universal service, you hear people talking, is the internet a right? The United Nations Declaration, I think, recognizes now that internet is a right. I think what we've got here is a case of if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, and we've got an act, the Telecommunications Act, we've got in there a provision that says all Canadians should have access to high quality, affordable, reliable services, whether they live in rural or urban areas. I think I'm almost quoting it, but it's mm-hmm. not exactly like that. You know, we have something there. We have the CRTC that looks into it from time to time to determine whether it's meeting those goals or not. You have a strong, at least rhetorical and, monetary commitment from the government on a recurring basis that doesn't always work out, but they're always trying, right? I think that this is what we mean when we talk about the right to communicate. So you can equivocate over whether it's officially recognized or not. You know, there's the bit in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms that says freedom of expression, including the press and mm-hmm. the means of communication, or something to that effect. It's the second provision. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not even a regular lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. You know, so I can't pretend to understand the implications of how a legal right mm-hmm. would interact with the Charter and from where it would be derived. But what we've got looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck. So I just tend to to point a shotgun at it. No, I'm just kidding. Right. So, I think that's where we're at. And in terms of rural and urban areas, you recognize that there's going to be difference mm-hmm. From one place to the next. So we were talking before, it might not be feasible to run a fiber optic cable to every island and none of it, mm-hmm. But you have to, they do recognize that the solutions are needed. It's terribly expensive in the north. And I think that they could be definitely taking a more, the CRTC, the federal government, Private industry, I think, is they're, you know, trying things out.
Mm-hmm.
But the three of them really need to work together to figure out a solution, and they need to do it better than they have in the past.
Yeah, especially if access to communications is considered a universal right.
Well, yeah, I mean, the CRTC has an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do their darndest to make sure that everybody has it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know? And that doesn't say except for people where it's really expensive.
No, absolutely.
Do you want to ask the...
So what provisions have been promised or are expected to be executed from the latest budget to address this?
I remember that the Conservative Party had committed money in one of their omnibus budget bills. I haven't been paying a terribly close attention to this Trudeau government in terms of budgets, but I have heard commitments from them, a certain amount of money. More than one zero in the millions. Will go into financing companies to install broadband to people who aren't presently served.
Mm-hmm. Would that scratch the surface of what is needed, though, or is it just kind of...
throwing money at the problem?
Well, yeah, a step in the right direction, but kind of...
But they're doing more of the same. The federal government needs to do that, but they... I mean, the sort of market first... We'll just give money to private companies and let them do it and then not check in on it. It's not the most efficient way of going about it. It hasn't solved the problems in the past. So, I think that I certainly wouldn't say they need to stop doing that, but I think that that they need to be a little more public-spirited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Well, they have the obligation for sure, and... thank you very much for all your insights on this topic. That's actually all the time we have for this today. And thank you very much again for coming.
Okay, great.
It's nice having you there. It's nice to be on my expertise level for once in this podcast. I'm the only communications person out of both teams, so I feel a little more at ease today.
Thank you for listening to Policy Talks. Stay tuned for our next episode with Mitch Robitaille and Mel Kamaganakin. Remember to visit us at policytalkspodcast.com and on Twitter at @PolicyTalksPod for updates and related content. If you have any feedback, comments, suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email or reach us on Facebook or Twitter.
A quick thanks to our research team who put this episode together, Christopher Brodkin, Mark Haken, Emily Vallée-Watts, and our producer, Joe Venkatesh. Until next time, I'm Josh.
And I'm Nicole. This is Policy Talks.
All right.